there's opportunity there, right? That's a great place to participate and be early to the game, because the platform algorithms will recommend you to people who are joining.
Hey gang, he's back. My pal Rand Fishkin joining me here on the Dealer Playbook podcast. We're going to be talking all about, wait for it, the death of marketing attribution. Say what? Stay tuned.
The car business is rapidly changing and modern car dealers are meeting the demand. I'm Michael Cirillo, and together we'll explore the best strategies, ideas, and tools to create a thriving life in and out of the business. This is the Dealer Playbook.
Rand, thanks so much for joining me back here on the Dealer Playbook podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time, in particularly because you are one of the few that I've come across, that I've followed, that I've become a fan of, who also just replies back to emails, which I think is so unique.
That is a low bar.
Well, but you know how it is. You've been at this for quite some time. I'm curious, was that ever a conscious decision? Like, I will be the guy that actually replies to people.
Oh, absolutely. I think I want to say this is 2002, 2003, 2004. I was very early in my career at the company that eventually turned into Moz, right? So doing SEO work. And I would email a lot of people in the search field, including people at Google and Microsoft at the time. And just never heard back from people in tech, from people in software. And I thought that was just a crappy way to treat new folks in the industry. And so I resolved to be someone who would always reply to every message. My one frustration is that over the last 20 years, the number of platforms on which I received messages has ballooned. And so I'm not nearly as good at replying consistently and effectively to my LinkedIn messages, for example, or my Twitter DMs, which I almost never check. But you're going to get an answer.
That's to be expected, though. I mean, the last time I checked here, 147,000 followers. I mean, that always boggles my mind that the town I grew up in was maybe 25,000 people. How exciting of a time do we live in where, of their own free will and testament, 147,000, and this is just LinkedIn, by the way, for context, 147,000 people are going, yeah, man, I'm picking up what this cat's putting down. Does that increase your sense of responsibility, or is it a thought? How do you internalize
that? I think about that a lot. I mean, one of the things that I'm very grateful for, I think you and I are of a similar age generation, right? That we got to grow up without that phenomenon.
Right.
I am insanely grateful. To be honest, I wish that social media in general were age restricted, right? Until you're 18 or something, you just can't use it. You're not allowed on any platform, because I don't think that form of parasocial relationship and fandom and the interactions that I see, I don't think that's healthy. I don't know any parent who'd be like, oh yeah, that's great for my kids. I love it. I do think as we become adults, especially in the, you know, sort of professional worlds, creative worlds, it's really wonderful to be able to find people with whom you resonate and then follow their interests and activities and become a fan. And they don't have to be someone who's famous, right? Like I've never been into the, I don't know, let's follow this actor or this singer or this artist or that kind of thing. But I do love the, oh, wow, that person does such an amazing, you know, craft hobby job with their woodworking. I just want to see their woodworking every few weeks when they have a new thing to share. Amazing. I think that's beautiful. I think that's kind of the best of humanity.
Yeah, I love it. It's, what a time to be alive. I don't know if we all turn into our parents. You brought up the whole generational thing, and I'm like, oh crap. The last time we spoke, these grays weren't here, and you know, and I'm getting old, and we all turn into our parents, and now I mean,
like, weird things happening where it's kind of going badger on me. I don't
know. it looks pretty sick though, pretty sophisticated, I gotta say. But I'm like, man, we all turn into our parents, because I'm sitting here going, well, golly, what a wonderful time to be alive, you know?
Right. But and I've never, you know, I think that there's this popular meme or thought that the kids feel like it's the worst time, right? That, you know, with climate issues and economic issues and those kinds of things. And I always have this like, gosh, I will grant that between the, you know, whatever it is, the sort of end of the Cold War and, you know, 2001, 9/11. Yeah, there was this brief period of sort of not a tremendous amount happening in the Western world that people were worried about. But with that exception, pretty sure every other time frame in history has been at least as or more chaotic and concerning as right now. So,
yeah, just in its own context and its own circumstances. Yeah, I often think about that, too. And I've never had the opportunity really to ask anybody with a really large following. I mean, the industry with which I work in, the retail auto industry.
Yeah.
If you have a really big following, and by really big, I mean like yours and larger, it's because somebody paid for bots somewhere because of just the ego of, you know, and so I've always had kind of a relatively small social following. Most listen on podcasts and things of that nature.
But well, I would make a recommendation, which is, so my social following on platforms tends to be extremely driven by the growth of those platforms as much or more so than my own participation there. So the fact that I was on LinkedIn very early talking about digital marketing at a time when not many people were meant that as more digital marketers joined LinkedIn and got connected, right, they started following me. Same thing happened on Twitter. You know, I think I have close to 500,000 Twitter followers. Granted, you know, Twitter has such little engagement now that I get almost as many interactions on Mastodon where I have like 5,000 followers. But Twitter, during Twitter's, you know, massive growth years, that sort of 2009 to 2014 time period, I was one of the recommended people to follow in the marketing world. And so everybody who joined was getting recommended to follow my account because I was active there. So, you know, as you see the rise of things like whatever Threads or TikTok, or you see a subreddit taking off, or you see a channel on YouTube. I know in the auto industry, YouTube is still huge, continues to be.
Right.
There's opportunity there, right? That's a great place to participate and be early to the game because the platform algorithms will recommend you to people who are joining.
Interesting. Now this leads me to this question. When it comes to marketing, when it comes to all of the different platforms and all of the different marketing activities that could be done, do you feel like sometimes maybe we just created a bigger problem for ourselves? Like we introduced a problem for ourselves that now is the thing it's the spider web we're trying to like get out of our hands.
I mean, I'm torn on this front. Okay. So three thoughts. One, I'm not sure you can hold marketers responsible for the diversity of platforms that exist on the web. I think that might be more driven by sort of free market economy and desire for competition. The second is I agree with you that, yes, there are many, many platforms. There are many places where you could participate. I don't think it is wise for any dealer or any small business to try and be all things to all people in all places. I think if you want to build something special, something that has that earns real traction with customers, you should get good at one or two things that you really love and are passionate about and where you have something unique to say on those platforms, rather than trying to be, you know, sort of the Gary V route of like, you got to be all the places, you got to hustle. I don't believe that at all. I've almost never seen that work. And then the third thing I would say is, weirdly, I want more platforms. I don't like the, you know, Google and Facebook holding 85-90% of all digital advertising dollars, you know, close to 100% if you include Apple and Amazon. Yeah. I think that sucks. I would much rather have a field like the search engine field, you know, of 2004, where we had, you know, four or five players with 25-30% market share. I'd much rather have a browser market that was more competitive. I think that, very frankly, you can see what Google does with huge market share, which is huge stock buybacks, which is good for nobody, next right. to nobody, right? Like there's like mm-hmm. a few hundred people that's, I suppose, nice for. You're a billionaire plus more now.
Congratulations.
And I would say that innovation really suffers when you get to that late stage monopoly form of capitalism. Like, you know, I just don't see the kind of innovation from Google the last few years that I saw in that 2008 to 2016 period. I think, you know, Google's just not, they don't have to try, right? They're kind of doing layoffs. They're throwing away all their experimental projects, and Wall Street loves them for it. So
this sucks. I love listening to you speak about this stuff first and foremost, because as the more of your information I've consumed and the more I've seen it work in my life and in my agency and, you know, obviously with my team, the more I've just really come to trust your instinct about this stuff. So I appreciate that. And I ask these questions because I know in retail automotive in particular, the landscape is so ambiguous. There's about 400 zillion providers doing everything under the sun. Everybody who leaves the dealership because they don't want to work retail anymore starts a marketing agency or starts an SEO company or starts a paid ads company. And then that just adds to this, oh, we've got to be everywhere all at once. And of course, you know, on LinkedIn, just this past couple of weeks, I posted about the potential threats of social media in that when people are there, they're often there to promote something. They use it as a billboard rather than to have conversations. And that leads to this feeling of what they're saying is absolute. This is the only way to do the thing, to get the result. And now all of a sudden, and you brought up Gary Vee, so I'm going to like jab him a little bit, no pun intended, which is this zombie syndrome that occurs, which is if I'm not doing it that way, then I feel less than. Mm. I don't feel like I'm stacking up. If I'm not posting 17 times a day or 20 times or whatever the thing is, I just don't think sometimes we think about the wake of desolation we leave in our path in pursuit of this idea of success. And I see that a lot on social. Hey, before we hop back into this episode of the Dealer Playbook, we got to give a shout out to today's sponsor, AutoFi. AutoFi helps progressive dealers like you sell smarter, not harder, on your dealership website and now in your showroom too. AutoFi solves the everyday problems dealers actually face, like bottlenecks at the sales desk, customer distrust, and decision overload. And their all-new showroom solution includes deal estimation, desking, lender routing, and an F&I menu, all in one powerful platform that bridges the gap between the CRM and DMS. Dealerships with AutoFi can manage the floor more efficiently, fast-track the yes, and make better lending decisions, enabling them to sell cars faster with higher satisfaction and more profit. In fact, deals with AutoFi take an average of 28 minutes from customer check-in to loan approval, and dealers are making $411 more back-end PVR per deal. Go to autofi.com/dealerplaybook to learn more. That's autofi.com/dealerplaybook and start selling smarter today. All right, let's hop back into this episode. You've had such a vast experience in marketing. You've seen the rise and the fall of many platforms and different strategies and different buzzwords and topics. Of course, Moz was all around, you know, the topic of SEO. What's crazy to me is that in retail automotive, I keynoted an event last July in Vegas. It was for the National Independent Auto Dealer Association, Rand. They are just starting to think about SEO.
I mean, you know, part of this is, part of me wonders, is that wise, right? Should they be embracing this channel that they're unfamiliar with and haven't invested in? Or should they look at, hey, here's all the things that made us really strong. Now let's go look at the channels that are aligned, potentially aligned with our unique strengths and our audience and where to reach them. And does it turn out that the right thing for them to do is play more exclusively on YouTube or be much more present on helping their dealers, right, and all the people connected to them do SEO rather than do it for themselves. I'm not saying those are the right answers. I just think it's strategically wise to ask those questions rather than to dive into something because whatever, it's hot or everybody else is doing it.
Yeah, that's the narrative. Every SEO company obviously says you got to do more SEO, or every paid ads company or so on and so forth. So now all of a sudden, they're starting to think about that. The rest of the industry moved through attribution and this need for attribution. And I think we've kind of hit a standstill, you know, on this whole attribution thing. And here you are with, you know, SparkToro that gives really awesome audience insights and helps you think about your marketing in a different way, in a way that it connects with customer. But you're moving on from this attribution thing. You're saying, hey, the marketing attribution is dead. How did you get there?
Yeah. So I think first off, it's really important that I define that I mean there's a difference between measurement and attribution, right? So measurement would be saying, how many new followers did I get? Or how many people visited my website? Or of the people who visited my website, how many people signed up for a free trial or signed up for our newsletter or, you know, made an appointment to come into the dealership.
Right.
Those are all measurement forms of things. Attribution is saying, for this customer who filled out the schedule an appointment form, we are going to attribute 20% of this, their customer value, their sale value to Google AdWords, and 15% to our Apple Ads campaign, and 17% to our Facebook campaign. And that's because we can see that, you know, the Facebook ad was seen by them twice during the last 60 days. And the Google Ads account says that they saw, you know, two ads and clicked on a paid search ad. That's attribution. I think attribution modeling is broken. And I think it's fundamentally misleading. I think that all of the big tech advertising companies, Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Taboola, Outbrain, you name them.
Yeah.
All of them have a huge incentive to make it look like they are responsible for the sales that you're getting. And if you buy ads from them, I promise you, they will make it look like sales that you are going to get anyway are because of the ad dollars you spent with them.
Right.
That's fundamentally like, misleading. It's wrong. And so yeah. I don't trust those attribution models the way I did 10 years ago.
Sure. This is, I mean, we see this all the time. We see agencies in automotive who take the CSV file from the CRM, upload it to Facebook ads. Facebook ads does however they do their thing. And then it's like, look at how many cars we sold you, which just rubs me the wrong way. I'm sure I've left millions of dollars on the table by just not being willing to adopt that narrative.
Yep.
But so many do and so many win.
This is the fundamental problem, right? Is that I think, unfortunately, the last 20 years of digital marketing has trained CEOs and especially CFOs and even some CMOs to trust what the Google Ads account says over what is really going on, which is them taking credit for sales that would have happened anyway. Very, very few, especially during the last, 15 years of kind of the cheap money era, right, of growth at all costs.
Yep.
Very few of those executives have been willing to do the hard thing, which is shut off the ads and see how many sales you get the next quarter. Because if you don't shut them off, if you don't do that testing, you will not know whether sales that were attributed would have happened anyway and what percent. It could be, right, that Facebook or Google or whoever is adding an additional 10%, 15%, 20%, maybe even more, right? I know some consumer B2C retail stuff at low price points where Instagram ads really are contributing 60, 70, 80% of sales. Fine, right? All right. But in many of these cases, the only way to know is to shut it off entirely and find out. And they're not willing to do it because they don't want to lose even the incremental 5%.
Right. But do you think how many do you think are thinking of it in terms of, oh, it would probably only contribute to an incremental 5% versus if we shut off that faucet, we are done for?
Yeah, I think that there are people. I think there's people who believe both, right? I think that there's probably some unsophisticated. This is me stereotyping a little bit, but some less sophisticated sort of C-suite folks. Especially, I'm gonna blame CFOs here, but who think that if Google says, you know, 60% of your sales saw a Google ad, they just take that at face value. Well, if they hadn't seen that ad, they wouldn't have come to us, right? That's the assumption. And very frustratingly, Michael, right, for a lot of agencies and for a lot of CMOs and directors of marketing,
yeah,
do you really want to convince your CFO that actually seeing an ad doesn't do all that much, right? Like you kind of have this pull and tug. Well, I know that attribution is wrong, but I don't want to tell them not to give me budget.
Right. Yeah. It's, oh man, I'm so fascinated by the ecosystems that create the context.
The politics we now live is within. Tough, right? The politics is really, it's a big part of why this problem exists. And frankly, I think, you know, a lot of the execs at Google, at Facebook, at Microsoft, at Apple, at Amazon, they know, right? Like they see this and they are exploiting. They're putting that finger on the button to exploit it. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the all the kerfuffle about Performance Max, right? PMax and Google.
Yeah.
This is an I don't know what exactly to call
We're
it, an
advertising it.
Program
yeah.
that you can opt into inside your Google Ads account, and it will automatically tweak and tune things that perhaps manually you were tuning and tweaking before. You get much less granular data out of it, so you don't see the keywords that are sending you traffic, and you don't see the variations, and the landing pages are somewhat hidden, all this kind of stuff. But yeah. Supposedly, you know, every Google rep is pushing Performance Max very hard on their customers, their agencies, their consultants, claiming that it will increase and improve the results. And the right response is, okay, but even if it does, for how long? And then once it no longer is, how will I know? And you've taken all the data away with these campaigns. And so I will no longer be able to go back and look historically and see, oh, these are terms and phrases and websites and YouTube channels that performed for me. It's all behind the scenes. It's hidden by this algorithm. I wouldn't trust it as far as I could throw the entire Google organization, right? Like, it seems it's insanity to me, but that's the way it's all trending.
I'm like, dang. You know, the last 4 years really ruined the phrase, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but.
Oh, my God. I mean, you saw the Justice Department's lawsuit against Google, right? And there was that document of evidence from, I'm trying to remember, it was like the head of the advertising team telling the Google execs, hey, you got to talk to the organic team and tell them to stop making the results so good because we're going to lose our bonuses this quarter. And I know everybody wants their bonus, right? So stop making the organic results so good and put the ad, you know, put more ads back on the top. Like just all the things that SEOs for years were like, gosh, is that really going on? Nah, I don't believe they would do that.
Yeah, no, corruption's happened in literally every other dispensation of time, but not ours.
Surely Google not is not like every other American corporation. No way.
Yeah, surely. No, but I thought, aren't they a 501c3? surely they're not here to bask in. They're like Scrooge McDuck jumping into their pool of coins.
I mean, so where I'm at on this is, should you have measurement and instrumentation? Absolutely, right? Measure the important things in your organization, measure the sales, measure traffic, measure where you're making investments. Should you trust attribution from third parties? Hell no. Should you try and build your own attribution system? No, I don't believe it's possible anymore. And this means that realistically, the only way to effectively engage in marketing from a scientific perspective, right, as opposed to just trust your gut, which by the way, I do a lot of and it works pretty good. So I'm not against that. But if you want to do it from a more scientific mathematic perspective, you have to basically test, iteratively test and measure performance like they did in the 20th century. Right. So, you know, if you think about what car dealerships, for example, were doing in 1950, right, it was, hey, let's buy a Yellow Page ad. We're going to buy it in this zip code, you know, or whatever for this county, but we're not going to buy it for that county. And then we're going to see what the lift is like, because these are two quite similar counties from a population, demographic perspective, whatever. Oh, hey, all right. We saw 5% more walk-ins and 10% more sales in the place where we did the Yellow Page ad. So we know what a Yellow Page ad is worth to us. So we're going to buy it in these 10 other counties. Frickin' great. That methodology still works today, right? You can still go, hey, we're going to put, we're going to have a $50,000, you know, podcast and YouTube strategy this year that belongs to this person. Your job is to get our brand mentioned on a bunch of podcasts in the local area, mentioned in local media, mentioned on local YouTube channels. And then we're going to see at the end of the year, okay, here's our number. Next year, we're going to turn it off for Q1. We're not going to invest in that. Huh. Look at that. Okay, walk-ins are down 4%, you know, emails are down 3%. That's what that was worth to us. Great.
You mean pick a strategy, define a strategy, and stick to it for long enough to measure it.
Yeah, long enough to measure it, and with the knowledge that you will not be able to attribute a sale. I can hear the response right now, right? Like if I were watching this show, I'd be like, Rand, wait a minute. Can't I just ask my customers, how did you hear about us? Isn't that still good attribution tracking? No, that has never been good attribution tracking. I invite you to do this. Go look up the research around jury trials and eyewitnesses, right? Where people say, I saw this thing happen.
Yep.
And I, you know, put my hand on a Bible and I swear in front of a jury and a judge that I saw this thing take place in exactly this way. And then whenever there's camera evidence, the eyewitness is wrong. People are not, we do not have reliable memories. Our memories are incredibly fallible. And if you want to collect the how did you hear about us data, go for it. Like, I don't have a problem with that. But if you trust it, if you attribute it, you should know, tragically, it's no better than, you know, the Google thing. It's just not as... it's not as biased in the direction of making one thing look good.
Yeah.
It's going to be biased in the direction that human memory is valuable. And that tends to be things that are recent and things that are popular. So if someone heard about you on a podcast or they heard about you on a local news station, they're often going to say, how'd you hear about us? Google.
Yep.
Right? Because like
that's the easiest answer.
Yeah, it's the easiest answer. It's the most similar. They don't really remember perfectly, or they think they perfectly remember. Oh, I remember. Yes, I Googled for this thing and you came up there. I invite you to try this. One of the best ways to test it is put something. Did you hear about us on very popular advertisement on TV show that's popular in your area? And a bunch of people will be like, yeah, yeah. That's where I heard about you, but you've never run an ad there, right? Like this is the best way to test that this doesn't work at all. And I've seen a few clever marketers be like, hey boss, let me just try this. And when they let them, they're like, okay, well, there you go. You can't trust what people say.
Yeah. Now I'm enraged. I'm like, yes, this is true. Preach. I mean, in the same way that everybody keeps telling me I look like Seth Rogen, and I'm like, have you actually looked at a picture of Seth Rogen and me side by side? We're not. Oh, because we have beards and glasses. Okay.
Yeah, I will say, I think if you close your eyes, you could hear that your voice and Seth's are probably 60-70% the same.
Wow. Right?
Oh, like I hear it a little bit.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'll take it. Yeah.
Which I think is a great thing, actually. My guess is, you know, if you wanted to really punk him.
Just throw on a wig.
Throw now on a wig, right? Like, style yourself that way and then walk into some LA clubs and see what happens.
I got to ask, though, now. You brought up the jury stuff. I got to know. Yeah. Are you and your wife big into, like, murder documentaries and stuff like that?
No, actually. Not so much. I've read a few murder mystery novels. I'm kind of, that's like a genre that I like. but I haven't watched a bunch of the TV shows. Geraldine doesn't do non-comedic television.
Okay, I think
she likes that.
Good.
She needs it to be funny.
A woman after my own heart, because my wife is all about the murder documentary stuff. And I don't know what happens to me, but I somehow like dream vicariously as if I'm the one in trouble, you know?
Yeah.
Like I wake up and I'm like, hey, I'm so sorry. But you made me think of that because every time somebody is put on jury or every time somebody is put as a witness, they get it. It's all backwards.
Mm. Yep.
It's all backwards. So that's what made me think that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mess. I do have a recommendation for you and for any of the viewers and listeners, which is if you like the combination of murder mystery and comedy, there's an Australian show called Deadlock, L-O-C-H.
Hold on.
And it's a Tasmanian murder mystery, and it is phenomenally well-written and hilarious. Has a little bit of what the kids call the cringe humor at the start, but then it really just gets better and better. Great character consistency, good writing, good mystery.
I'm all about comedy. I love fast, witty comedy, you know, like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, like that. I just love it.
Oh, Andre Braugher. breaks my heart.
Ever since I started my health and fitness journey, I just think of Captain Schultz. I'm just like, or Holtz. And I'm just like, food. I do not enjoy food. I just need a beige paste that delivers the essential vitamins and nutrients.
Oh, man. Not me. Food is a huge part of my world.
But. Oh, I know. Well, the Italian in me is like, let me just eat what I want. America. Man, I've had so much fun. You have just shared so much wisdom. It's so common sense. Let me ask you a little bit about where you guys are headed with Spark Toro. Sure. Maybe tell those that aren't quite familiar with what that software does, all about it and how you would recommend using a software like Spark Toro to help shape a marketing strategy.
Yeah. So, I mean, at its core, what Spark Toro does is audience research, which I think an example is probably the easiest way to go. So let's say, for example, that you wanted to reach interior designers in Los Angeles. You could search for people whose bio includes, you know, interior designer LA, and Spark Toro would show you details, data about hundreds or thousands of those people that we have in our database. That we get from publicly crawling and then sort of aggregating data across a bunch of different systems. And we would tell you, okay, well, they are likely to visit these websites and they're likely to listen to these podcasts and go to and watch these YouTube channels. And they're likely to search for these keywords. They're likely to have these words and phrases in their bio. And they're likely to... visit these subreddits and subscribe to them. All of that data can be used to then say, you know what? Our team's actually really good at Reddit. Let's go participate in these 10 subreddits where we can see that there's activity from interior designers in LA. That's how we're going to sort of get the word out about our new product or service or that kind of thing. This can be incredibly useful and powerful because frustratingly, and I'm sure you've noticed this, Michael, right? Like that data, which used to be available in things like your Google Ads account or your Facebook page, right? Remember before the Cambridge Analytica scandal, Facebook would tell you all these details about like the bios and demographics, psychographics, other pages they visit and subscribe to, other websites they visited of your audience, right? So like it made it really valuable to have a Facebook page with a big audience because pre-2016, you get all this data about them. Twitter used to have their Twitter analytics that would show you all that stuff. Google would show you that stuff. It's all gone. And so we were like, man, this is BS. Like the way that people should be able to do audience research, it can't just be surveys and interviews. Like that takes months of work and it's so expensive if you want to hire a professional survey firm to design it. You know, the big companies, they get all this data. Like they get it from their own analytics and metrics and then they'll go to, you know, whatever, like sketchy banks will sell it to them and credit cards will sell it to them and they'll be able to piece it all together. There's a few enterprise solutions, right? So if Spark Toro is sort of not your speed, you could try Brandwatch, which is expensive, but very good. But we were like, this shouldn't be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. How do we make it like $100 a month or less, right? For people to get information about their audience and what they do on the web and who they are. That's what SparkToro does. And I think the right way to use audience research is essentially twofold. One is in your planning stage. So strategically, as you're sort of thinking about, what am I going to do in 2024? Like, what are tactics and channels, opportunities I'm going to execute on that I haven't done before? That data is invaluable, right? Like, that will really help you make smarter decisions about, oh, my audience is here and they do these things and they follow these channels. Okay, I think I could do something unique that is in that vein that will help me stand out on, you know, YouTube or Reddit, or when I pitch podcasts, or when I pitch local media, or when I sponsor these websites, email newsletters, whatever it is. And the second one is the tactics of which one, right? So, for example, we were talking about Geraldine, my wife, who's got her second book coming out, and she I like walked her through SparkToro, and she just went through a huge list of, oh, these are the sources of influence that reach the audience for my book, which is kind of at the intersection of food and feminism. And she's like, okay, well, these are the sources of influence that are popular with that audience. I'm going to go figure out who in my network knows somebody there. I'm going to reach out. I'm going to pitch them. I'm going to have my publisher pitch them. That's where I'm going to direct my PR team. So those are the two big use cases. And then there's plenty of like corporate folks who have to design personas and they use SparkToro for that, or people who do media buys and they use SparkToro for that. People do link building outreach right in the SEO world and they use it for that, or keyword research and they use it for that. So there's strategic and tactical things, but that's a broad overview.
I love, so as somebody that uses it, I was really interested, especially in, as we seek to expand the impact of the dealer playbook and everything that we do here. What I love about what you're saying, I experienced immediately just that knowledge of, oh, the likelihood of that. Immediately, my brain just started moving in a direction that without that data, I'm always sitting here like, huh, what could we do? What just that triggering of ideas, that stimulation of ideas for me has been invaluable. So definitely we recommend all of you watching and listening to go check out SparkToro. It is an awesome tool. Rand, you've been so gracious with your time. I always love getting to learn from you and sit with you and chat. And now I know you're a Brooklyn Nine-Nine guy. So, I mean, there's that thing now. But I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Dealer Playbook podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Dealer Playbook podcast. If you enjoyed tuning in, please subscribe, share, and hit that like button. You can also join us and the DPB community on social media. Check back next week for a new Dealer Playbook episode. Thanks so much for joining.